Chapter 21. Some Tricks of the Power. Len knew the ride to Chachin would be one he would rather forget, and the journey met his expectations. They rode hard, passing merchants' trains of wagons, never stopping long in a village and sleeping under the stars most nights, since no one had the coin for inns, not for four people with horses. Barns and haylofts had to do, when there was a barn or hayloft to be found come nightfall. Many of the hills along the road bore neither village nor farm, only towering oak and leatherleaf, pine and fir, with smaller beech and sour gum scattered through. In the borderlands, there were no such things as isolated farms. Sooner or later, a farm set off by itself became a graveyard. Alice continued her search for the Sahara woman in every village they passed, though she fell silent whenever Lan or one of the others approached, and eyed them frostily until they went away. The woman had a ready way with a frosty eye. For him, anyway. Rhine twitched and peered wide-eyed at her, fetched and trotted and offered up compliments like a courtier on a leash, still bouncing between enraptured and fearful, and she accepted his subservience and his praise alike as her due, while laughing at his witticisms. Not that she focused only on him. She seldom let an hour go by without probing questions directed at each of them in turn, till it seemed she wanted to know the entire story of their lives. The woman was like a swarm of black flies. No matter how many you swatted, there were always more to bite. Even Rhine knew enough to deflect that sort of interrogation. A man's past belonged to himself and the people who had lived it with him. It was not a matter for gossip with an inquisitive woman. Despite her questions, Bukama continued his carping. Day and night, it seemed, every second comment out of his mouth regarded the pledge. Lan began to think the only way to silence the man would be to take oath not to give her the pledge. Twice, thick black clouds rolled down out of the blight to unleash driving downpours of freezing rain mixed with hail large enough to crack a man's head. The worst storms in spring came from the blight. When the first of those clouds darkened the sky to the north, he began looking for a place where the tree's branches might be thick enough to afford some shelter, maybe with the aid of blankets stretched overhead. But when Alice realized what he was doing, she said coolly, "There is no need to stop, Master Lan. You are under my protection." Doubtful of that, he was still looking when the storm struck. Lightning flashed in blue-white streaks across a sky that seemed suddenly night, and thunder crashed like monstrous kettle drums overhead. But the driving rain sheeted down an invisible dome that moved with their horses, and the hailstones bounced off it in an eerie silence, as though they had struck nothing at all. She performed the same service for the second storm, and both times she seemed surprised at their offered thanks. Her face hardly altered in its smoothness, a very good imitation of an Aes Sedai's serene expression, but something flickered above her eyes. A strange woman. They saw bandits, as rumored, usually a pack of 10 or 12 roughly dressed men, who counted the odds against 3 with arrows knocked and melted back into the trees before Lan and the rest reached them. He or Bukama always went after them, just far enough to make sure they really had gone, while the other two guarded Alice. It would have been foolish to ride into an ambush they knew might be waiting. Noon on the fourth day found them riding through the forested hills along a road that stretched empty as far as the eye could see in either direction. The sky was clear, with just a few scattered white clouds drifting high up, and the only sounds were their horses' hooves and squirrels chittering on branches. Suddenly horsemen burst from the trees on both sides of the road some 30 paces ahead, 20 or so scruffy fellows who formed a line blocking the way, and the pounding of hooves told of more behind. Dropping his reins in the pommel of his saddle, Lan snatched 2 more arrows and held them between his fingers as he drew the one already knocked. He doubted he would have time for even a second shot, but there was always a chance. 3 of the men in front of him wore much battered breastplates stained with rust over their dirty coats, and one had a rust-spotted helmet with a barred face guard. None carried a bow, not that that made any great difference.
23 behind at 30 paces, Bukama called. No bows. On your word.
No difference at all against a band large enough to attack most merchant trains. He did not loose, however. So long as the men only sat their horses, a chance remained. A small one. Life and death often turned on small chances.
"Let's not be too hasty," the helmeted man called, removing it to reveal a grizzled head of greasy hair
and a narrow, dirty face that had last been touched by a razor a week gone. His wide smile showed two missing teeth.
"You might be able to kill two or three of us before we cut you down, but there's no need for that. Let us have your coin and the pretty lady's jewelry, and you can go on your way. Pretty ladies in silk and fur always have lots of jewels, eh?"
He leered past Lan at Alice. Maybe he thought it a friendly smile. There was no temptation in the offer. These fellows wanted no casualties among themselves if they could manage it so, but surrender meant that he and Bukama and Ryan would have their throats slit. They probably intended to keep Alice alive until they decided she was a danger. If she had some trick of the power up her sleeve, he wished she would...
"You dare impede the way of an Aes Sedai?"
she thundered. And it was thunder, setting some of the brigands' horses snorting and plunging. Cat Dancer, knowing what dropped reins meant, remained still beneath him, awaiting the pressures of knee and heel.
"Surrender, or face my wrath."
And red fire exploded with a roar above the bandits' heads, sending more of their mounts into panicked bucking that tumbled two of the poorer riders to the road.
"I told you she was Aes Sedai, Coy,"
whined a fat, balding fellow in a breastplate that was too small for him.
"Didn't I say that, Coy? A green with her three warders, I said."
The lean man backhanded him across the face without taking his eyes from Lan, or more likely from Alice behind him.
"No talk of surrender now. There's still 50 of us and 4 of you. Rather than face the noose, we'll take our chances on how many you can kill before we take you."
"Well and good," Lan said. "But if I can see one of you at count of 10, it begins."
With the last word, he started counting in a loud voice. The bandits did not let him reach 2 before they were galloping back toward the trees. By 4, the dismounted pair stopped trying to gain the saddles of their wild-eyed animals and took off afoot as fast as they could go. There was no need to follow. The pounding and crackle of horses being galloped through brush rather than around it was fast fading into the distance. In the circumstances, it was the best end that could be hoped for. Except that Alice did not see it so.
"You had no right to let them go,"
she said indignantly, anger flashing in her eyes as she did her best to skewer each of them with her gaze. She reined her mare around to make certain they each received a dose.
"Had they attacked, I could have used the one power against them. How many people have they robbed and murdered? How many women ravished? How many children orphaned? We should have fought them and taken the survivors to the nearest magistrate."
Lan, Bukama, and Ryan took turns trying to convince her how unlikely it was that any of the 4 of them would have been among the survivors. The bandits would have fought hard to avoid the gallows, and sheer numbers did count. But she actually seemed to believe she could have defeated close on 50 men by herself. A very strange woman. Had it been only storms and bandits, that would have been more than he expected on any journey. Ryan's foolishness and Bukama's complaints could have been taken as a matter of course, too. But Alice was blind about a great deal, and that made all the difference. That first night, he had sat in the wet to let her know he would accept what she had done. If they were to travel together, better to end it with honors even, as she must see it. Except that she did not. The second night, she remained awake till dawn and made sure he did as well, with sharp flicks of an invisible switch whenever he nodded off. The third night, sand somehow got inside his clothes and boots, a thick coating of it. He had shaken out what he could and, without water to wash, rode covered in grit the next day. The night after the bandits, he could not understand how she managed to make ants crawl into his small clothes and make them all bite at once. It had been her doing for sure. She was standing over him when his eyes shot open, and she appeared surprised that he did not cry out. Clearly she wanted some response, some reaction, but he could not see what. If she felt that she had not been repaid for her wetting, then she was a very hard woman. But a woman could set the price for her insult or injury, and there were no other women here to call an end when she went beyond what they considered just. All he could do was endure until they reached Chachin. The following night she discovered a patch of blister leaf near their campsite, and to his shame, he almost lost his temper. He did not mention the incidents to Bukama or Ryan, of course, though he was certain they knew. But he began to pray for Chachin to loom up ahead at the next rise. Perhaps a Dane had set the woman to watch him, but it was beginning to seem she meant to kill him after all. Slowly.
Moiraine could not understand the stubbornness of this landman Dragoran, though Swan said that stubborn was a redundancy when it came to men. All she wanted was a display of remorse for dunking her. Well, that and an apology. An abject apology, and a proper regard for an Aes Sedai. But he never displayed the slightest scrap of penitence. He was frozen arrogance to the core. His disbelief of her right to the shawl was so plain, he might as well have spoken aloud. A part of her admired his fortitude, but only a part. She would bring him properly to heel. Not to tame him utterly. A completely tame man was no use to himself or anyone else. But to make certain he recognized his mistakes right down to his bones. She allowed him his days to reflect while she planned what she would do to him that night. The ants had been a great disappointment. That was one of the Blue Aja's secrets, a way to repel insects or make them gather and bite or sting, though not intended for the use she had put it to. But she was quite proud of the blister leaf, which at least made him jump a bit. Proving that he really was made of human flesh. She had begun to doubt that. Oddly, neither of the other men ever offered him a word of commiseration that she heard, though they had to know what she was doing. If he voiced no complaints to her, which was peculiar enough in itself, surely he did to his friends. That was one thing friends were for. But the three were strangely reticent in other ways, too. Even in Kyrian, people would talk about themselves, a little, and she had been taught that borderlanders shunned the game of houses, yet they revealed almost nothing about themselves, even after she primed their tongues with incidents from her own youth in Kyrian and from the tower. Rhine at least laughed when the story was funny. Once he realized he was supposed to laugh, he did. But Lan and Bukama actually looked embarrassed. She thought that was the emotion they displayed. They could have taught Aes Sedai to control their faces. They admitted having met sisters before her, but when she probed ever so delicately to learn where and when.
"There are Aes Sedai so many places that they are difficult to recall," Lan replied one evening as they rode ahead of their own long shadows. "We'd best stop at those farmhouses ahead and see whether we can hire the use of a hayloft for the night. We won't see another house till well after full dark."
That was typical. Those three could have taught Aes Sedai about oblique answers and deflecting questions, too. Worst of all, she still had no idea whether any of them were dark friends. Of course she had no real reason to think that any of the sisters in Canluum had been Black Aja, and if they were not, Rhine's visit to the Gates of Heaven likely had had some purely innocent purpose, yet wariness made her continue her questions. She still laid a ward around each of them every night. She could not afford to trust anyone except Swan until she was sure of them. Other Aes Sedai and any men who might be involved with them least of all. 2 days from Chachin, in a village called Ravinda, she finally located Aveen Sahira, the very first woman she spoke to in the place. Ravinda was a thriving village, though much smaller than Manala, with a wide field of hard-packed dirt that served as a market for folk from neighboring villages to barter produce and handcrafts and buy from peddlers. 2 peddlers' wagons, their tall canvas covers festooned with pots and pans, stood surrounded by crowds when she and her reticent companions arrived that morning, each peddler glaring at his competitor despite the people clamoring for his own goods. Ravinda also had an inn under construction, the second floor already building, the result of Mistress Sahira receiving the bounty. She intended to call it the White Tower.
"You think the sisters might object?" she said, frowning at the sign already carved and painted and hung above the front door, when Moiraine suggested a change in the name. By the scale, the tower on the sign would have had to be over 1,000 feet high. Aveen was a plump, graying woman with a silver-mounted, foot-long dagger hanging at her worked leather belt and yellow embroidery covering the sleeves of her bright red blouse. Apparently the bounty had put a touch of feast day into every day for her. Finally she shook her head.
"I can't see why they would, my lady.
The Aes Sedai who took names in our camp was very soft-spoken and pleasant. The woman would learn, the first time a sister who cared to reveal herself happened by. Moiraine wished she remembered which accepted had taken Aveen Sahira's name and had a chance to give the child a piece of her mind. Aveen's son, Miguel, her 10th child, had been born 30 miles from Dragonmount and a week before Gitara spoke her foretelling. That sort of carelessness in writing down what you heard was intolerable. How many more names in her book would turn out to have borne children outside the specified 10 days? Riding away from Ravinda, the men's obvious delight that she had been quick turned her smoldering irritation from the unknown accepted to them. Oh, they did not show it openly, but she heard Rhines say it. At least she was fast with it this time, not quite prudent enough about being overheard, and Bukama muttered a sour agreement as they fell in behind her. Lan was riding ahead, plainly shunning her company. In truth, she could understand that, but his broad back, stiffly erect, seemed a rebuke. She began to think on what she might arrange for him that night, with perhaps a touch for the other two as well. For a time, nothing came to mind that could top what she had already done. Then a wasp buzzed past her face, and she watched it fly into the trees alongside the road. Wasps. Of course, she did not want to kill him. Master Lan, are you allergic to wasp stings? He twisted in his saddle, half reining his stallion around, and suddenly grunted, his eyes growing wide. For an instant she did not understand. Then she saw the arrowhead sticking out from the front of his right shoulder. Without thought she embraced the source, and Zydar filled her. It was as though she were back in the testing again. Her weaves flashed into being. First of all, a clear shield of air to block any more arrows away from Lan, then one for herself. She could not have said why she wove them in that order. With the power in her and her sight sharpened, she scanned the trees where the arrow had come from and caught motion just inside the edge of the forest. Flows of air lashed out to seize the man just as he loosed again, the shaft going up at an angle as his bow was snapped tight against his body. Just heartbeats, that all took, beginning to end, as fast as anything she had woven in testing. Just enough time for 2 arrows fired by Rhine and Bukama to strike home. With a dismayed groan, she released the bonds of air, and the man toppled backward. He had attempted murder, but she had not intended holding him up as a target for execution. He would have been executed once they had carried him to a magistrate, yet she disliked having been part of carrying out the sentence, especially before it was given. To her mind it came very near using Zydar as a weapon, or making a weapon for men to use in killing. Very near. Still holding Zydar, she turned to Lan to offer healing, but in spite of the arrows sticking from him front and back, he gave her no chance to speak, wheeling his mount and galloping to the edge of the trees, where he dismounted and strode to the fallen man, followed by Bukama and Rhine. With the power in her, she could hear their voices clearly.
"Cunny Adrin?" Lan said, sounding shocked.
"You know this fellow?" Rhine asked.
"Why?"
Bukama growled, and there came the thud of a boot meeting ribs. A weak voice answered in gasps.
"Gold! Why else? You still have the Dark One's luck, turning just then, or that shaft would have found your heart. He should have told me she's Aes Sedai, instead of just saying to kill her first."
As soon as she heard those words, Moiraine dug her heels into Arrow's flanks to gallop the short distance and flung herself from the saddle, already preparing the weave for healing. "Get those arrows out of him," she called as she ran toward them, holding up her cloak and skirts to keep from tripping. "If the arrows remain, healing will not keep him alive."
"Why heal him?"
Lan asked, sitting himself down on a storm-fallen tree. Its great spread of dirt-covered roots rose in a fan high above his head.
"Are you so eager to see a hanging?"
"He's dead already," Rhine said. "Can you heal that?" He sounded interested in seeing whether she could. Moiraine's shoulders slumped. Kenny Adrin's eyes, open and staring up at the branches overhead, were already glazed and empty. Strangely, despite the blood around his mouth, he looked a beardless youth in his rumpled coat. Man enough to do murder, though. Man enough to die with a pair of arrows transfixing his chest. Dead, he could never tell her if it was this Gorthanas who had hired him, or where the man might be found. A nearly full quiver was fastened to his belt, and two arrows stuck upright in the ground nearby. Apparently he had been confident he could kill four people with four shots. Even knowing Lan and Bukama, he had thought so. Knowing them, he had disobeyed his instructions and tried to kill Lan first. The most dangerous of them, as he must have thought. As she studied the man, it came to her that he might tell her a little, even dead. With her belt knife, she sliced away the pouch hanging behind his quiver and emptied the contents beside him amid the small weeds pushing through the mulch. A wooden comb, a half-eaten piece of cheese covered with lint, a small folding knife, a ball of string that she unwound to make sure nothing was hidden inside, a filthy crumpled handkerchief that she unwadded with the tip of her knife blade. It had been too much to hope for a letter written by Master Gorthanas giving instructions on how to find him. Cutting the cords of the leather purse tied to Cunyadrin's belt, she upended that over the litter. A handful of silver and copper spilled out, and 10 gold crowns. So, the price of her death in Kandor was the same as the price of a silk dress in Tarvalin. Fat coins, with the rising sun of Kyrian on one side and her uncle's profile on the other. A fitting footnote in the history of House Domodred. "Have you taken to robbing the dead?" Lan asked in that irritatingly cool voice. Just asking, not accusing, but still. She straightened angrily just as Rhine snapped off the feathered end of the arrow jutting from Lan's back. Bukama was knotting a narrow strip of rawhide behind the arrowhead. Once he had it tight, he gripped the cord in his fist and gave one quick yank, pulling the arrow the rest of the way through. Lan blinked. The man had an arrow pulled out of his body, and he blinked. Why that should irritate her, she did not know, but it surely did. Rhine hurried back to the road, while Bukama helped Lan off with his coat and shirt, revealing a puckered hole in his front. Likely the one behind was no better. The blood that had been soaking into coat and shirt began to pour freely down his chest and ribs. Neither man asked for healing, and she was of half a mind not to offer it. More scars decorated Lan than she expected on a man so young, and a number of partly healed wounds crossed by neat dark stitches. Seemingly he angered men as easily as he did women. Rhine returned, carrying bandaging cloths and mouthing bread for a poultice. None of them were going to ask for healing until the man bled to death. "Will you accept healing?" she asked coldly, reaching toward Lan's head. He shied back from her touch. He shied back.
"Day after tomorrow in Chachin, you may need your right arm," Bukama muttered,
scrubbing a hand under his nose and not meeting anyone's eyes. A very peculiar thing to say, but she knew there was no point in asking what it meant. After a moment, Lan nodded and leaned forward. That was all. He did not ask or even accept her offer. He just leaned forward. She clapped her hands on his head in something near to a pair of slaps and channeled. The convulsion when the healing weave hit him, arms flinging wide, ripped him out of her grasp. Very satisfying. Even if he did only breathe hard, rather than gasp. His old scars remained. The half-healed wounds were now thin pink lines. The stitches that had been on the outside, now loose, slid down his arms and chest. He might have difficulty picking out the rest, but smooth skin marked where the arrow holes had been. He could meet the wasps in perfect health. She could always heal him again afterward if need be. Only if need be, however. They left the coins lying beside Kenyadrin's body, though the men plainly could have used them. They wanted nothing from the dead man. Bukama found his mount tied a short distance away in the trees, a white-stockinged brown gelding with a look of speed about him and a prancing step. Lan removed the animal's bridle and tied it to the saddle, then slapped the horse's rump and sent him racing toward Ravinda.
"So he can eat until somebody finds him," he explained, when he saw her frowning after the gelding.
In all truth, she had been regretting not searching the saddlebags tied behind the gelding's saddle. But Lan had shown a surprising touch of kindness. She had not expected any such to be found in him. For that, he would escape the wasps. There had to be something memorable in any case. She had only 2 more nights to crack him, after all. Once they reached Chachin, she would be too busy to attend to Lan Mandragoran. For a time, she would be.